connecting to the internet.
Internet.
Networking software.
World Wide Web for web.
Computer today.
Computer.
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 NetSurfer Pro.
The year is 2K24. Y2K24. Hundreds, if not thousands, if not millions, if not billions of Windows systems are down due to the actions of one company. But not mine, because I had turned mine on yesterday, and I have a bad habit of not turning off my computer when I go to bed. However, not all is wrong. There is some light in the darkness. Weird Al has just released a new polka medley. I actually seriously can't believe it.
Yeah, this is kind of insane news. The last one was like 2014, 2015.
I'm glad you asked. I should have taken this note earlier. 2014 was his last album with Mandatory Fun. After that, I believe he did a like Hamilton polka medley, but that doesn't count.
Yeah, that's Hamilton. That's a yeah. Hamilton thing. If I listen to the soundtrack of Hamilton and it gets to the end, it plays that medley. That's how not Weird Al of a thing the Hamilton medley is.
So, like, okay, there's a number of layers to this that I would want to actually talk about. For one thing, it's really funny to me because, so, Weird Al, obviously, the big thing with, like, parody songs, he was the parody guy.
Yeah.
I think nowadays, though, with the internet, parody songs are a big thing on YouTube and SoundCloud, but mainly YouTube, especially. And part of why Weird Al, like, stopped doing albums, not only is it because he's getting old and, like, wanted to retire and spend time with his family, but also because he viewed that the album format wasn't working for parodies anymore. The problem would be that he would write parodies for songs, but due to the length that it takes to produce, write, record, release an album, the songs would already be out of fashion, or the subjects of the parody would be out of fashion by the time he actually gets the album out. And so the idea was that he could just hypothetically do the release method of these other online parody artists by just making parodies whenever he really wants to. Of course, he really hasn't done that. He has only released a few songs since then. There was the Captain Underpants theme song for the movie. Great
banger
movie.
Banger song. Banger movie, banger song.
Yeah. There was the aforementioned Hamilton musical, and then when Weird the Al Yankovic story out, there was music related to that, but it wasn't completely, like, the same category as his previous more, like, pop culture parodies.
Yeah. I want to say that, like, during 2014 with Mandatory Fun, he kind of experimented with, like, essentially just, you know, releasing a bunch of different singles that were then collated into the album, of course.
Yeah.
Because that was, you know, during the period of, like, Word Crimes. That was during the period of, I wish I could remember any of the other songs on that album.
I remember First World Problems, because it took him so long to make a Pixies parody.
Yeah. It was a really fun bit of news at the time, and my God, I hope that this most recent medley is a sign of another album to come, because it has been a decade.
It's really funny too. So I grew up being a huge weeb, and I used to and still do follow the like Nico Nico Doga medley scene, which is like a topic for an entire episode, essentially. But I always really liked medleys as a form of, like, remix, because it's essentially not only taking songs and putting them in a line, but, like, a good medley is about matching the song's beat and tone and key and rhythm to create something that moves more seamlessly, yet is still able to have, like, quiet parts and loud parts, crescendos, decrescendos, andantes, and ritirandos, where you speed up and slow down. I know music terms. And I think Weird Al typically does a really good job at this. He'll tend to have, like, more interstitial transitions with more typical polka standards. He'll have the wamp, 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 wamp.
Yeah. There's a lot of specific bits in that, like, are through lines throughout a lot of his medleys.
Yeah.
That are very fun to get to the point where when it got to the last song of this medley, which, spoiler alert, Not as much as you can spoilers spoil a for, song.
Spoilers for Polkamania by Weird Al, released in July 19th, 2024.
Yeah, if you don't want to be spoiled, please don't listen to any of the rest of this episode at all. Go home, turn off all electronics, and sit in silence. But the last song is Shake It Off by Taylor Swift, because you gotta have Taylor in there.
Yeah.
But, like, the fact that it, you know, it went on for, like, one stanza too long made me go, oh, this is the exit track.
Yeah.
Because, like, you know, there's always, there's the bit that, like you said, it's like the blah, 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 blah. There's also, like, the breakdown bit where, I don't know if there was one in this one, but in most of his other ones, it has the breakdown where, like, you kind of get the wind down.
That's sort of what Shape of You was.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. It's funny because that is also a pretty big part of the Japanese Niku Niku Doka medley scene, of having like a three-act structure, or three-movement structure within your medley, where you have like a loud movement and then a quiet movement in the middle and then another loud movement. It's really interesting how, like, conceptually a lot of the framework from like the music theory side really matches up between the two. But anyways, I feel like Weird Al, as far as like the pop music, the American pop music side of things, Weird Al is the only one that really does it. There are people who have done medleys for other songs, but, like, oftentimes I see people just, like, do a song and then they immediately jump to another song without any sort of flow or motion, and it really bothers me.
Yeah.
It's like, I feel like a lot of people on YouTube who do, like, 200 Mario song medleys, it's like, they go do, 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 and they play through that, and then they go do, 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 do. And then instead of looping, they immediately go like, boo, doo, 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 doo. But like what I'm trying to get at is it tends to not really beat match the way you would want. Even DJs are often much better at this, and they're using the complete original samples because sort of the foundation of DJing and beat matching is to make a mix that doesn't jump so harshly so that the dance can keep going.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want to harsh the vibe by having such a rough cut. But like a lot of people online who make like pop music medleys or like video game music medleys just don't do that. And it's really annoying. Al typically does a very good job at that, I think. It again does help that he has a band playing the music rather than using the original samples. So he is able to just have little ditties in between songs.
Yep.
But at the same time, I think even when he doesn't do that, he's still usually very good about it.
Yep. Special shout out also has to go to the animation of the video, yeah, which is done by a number of regulars at this point.
Yeah. So Weird Al has often brought on independent animators to do music videos for him. And for the polkas, he started having multiple animators where each animator does one section of the song. And I love this. This is something he's done for a long time. His sort of, I don't know, like, just, there's a really interesting range of animators he tends to bring on, like Syriac, who you may know as the creator of Cows, 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 alongside a whole lot of other fucked up things. Fantastic, like, collage animator.
Yeah.
One of my favorite internet animators, and one where you see the style and you immediately know who it is. But, like, Syriac does the first little animation on this, and I was like, holy shit, okay. But my favorite bit is for the Uptown Funk section of the song. They have, is it R. Wappen? Who is the person who created a fan-made Albuquerque music video on Newgrounds.
I would go so far as to say the fan-made Albuquerque video.
Yeah, the fan-made Albuquerque video doesn't even look like Al, the character that they've drawn.
Yeah.
But has become an iconic stand-in for Al on the internet and is present in this music video.
Yeah. It's really lovely, especially just because, like, you know, that was one of the, like, when I think about early internet and Weird Al, I think about Albuquerque and I think about That's Your Horoscope for Today.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, it's wonderful to see Al paying homage to these creators by bringing them back on.
Hopefully paying.
Yeah, hopefully literally paying homage.
I'm pretty sure there was another music video, either off Mandatory Fun or Alpocalypse, that he also had this animator on for.
Yeah, because I know that the little character that the little owl character has been in a couple of other ones.
Yeah.
That I believe some are official.
It's funny because They Might Be Giants also tends to use a lot of fan animators in their music videos, and there are some that I've seen do both They Might Be Giants and Weird Al.
Nice.
I don't remember the name of the animator, but there's a person who did the music video for Skipper Dan by Weird Al, also did the music video for Damn Good Times by They Might Be Giants.
Did they also do Party in the CIA around the same period?
I don't remember if they did or not.
They have
a very, like, construction paper art style, sort of.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, Weird Al, if you want to come on and talk about Nico Nico Doga,
yeah,
that's the newest outstanding offer.
I think that's a pretty good one.
Yeah.
It's probably a better one, but yeah, I don't know. It's great. It is interesting because he sort of released it with the tagline that it's a polka of, like, the past 10 years. And there's definitely some songs that I think are not really irrelevant, but definitely out of fashion already.
Yeah.
The big one being Hello by Adele. That was one where I heard it and I was like, I'm not sure I really get this inclusion. But for the most part, other ones I could understand. Like, Shake It Off is a slightly older Taylor song at this point, but if you're going to have a Taylor Swift song, then you might as well. It's, like, kind of firmly past her sort of early pop country roots.
Yeah.
Into her pop.
Her pop roots.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the one thing I was disappointed by is that and I believe I said Sabrina Carpenter in the car, and I want to say that it is Sabrina Carpenter, the vampire pole, I probably would have preferred a different song of hers.
Vampire. No, it's Olivia Rodrigo.
Olivia Rodrigo!
I was even thinking of that in the car. I was like, isn't that Olivia Rodrigo? But I wasn't sure.
Yeah.
I mean, it's either Vampire or Good For You, which is the Paramore song. That's a joke. I don't actually believe Olivia Rodrigo ripped off of Paramore.
I am not
going to make any accusations about industry plant status on this podcast.
I'm looking at our lawyers. They're nodding. Okay, they're nodding at us. Okay, good.
Okay, good.
However, the fact that I've had to look over at my lawyers and I wasn't even at fault this time means that we should probably move on to our real topic today.
Yeah.
So, speaking of things that are popular on the internet.
Speaking of fan animators.
Hey, that's
and
good.
And fan
good.
Work. So, have we talked about Sonic before?
We definitely have talked about Sonic, but I don't know that we've talked at length about Sonic.
We did a Shadow the Hedgehog episode.
Yeah, we did
That's
a Shadow
right.
the Hedgehog episode, so, like, we did talk about it then.
Yeah. So, Sonic, if you need a refresher, is the hedgehog, the blue guy. You might have seen the movie with Ben Schwartz playing a blue character again, as he is known to do now. Benny Schwa, if you want to come on and talk shit about Scott Aukerman. No, okay, we can't keep doing this. So Sonic the Hedgehog is a really interesting series and character, but not because of, like, the intricacy of the series and the content itself. It is a series that exists almost entirely, well, not entirely, but, like, since its whole history, it has existed both in games but out of games. Because in a lot of ways, Sonic was like a marketing team's ICBM. Test tube grown like the Powerpuff Girls to be extremely hip and marketable.
But unfortunately, when he was mixed together, they crashed a vial that had rad attitude.
Well, no, the rad attitude was part of the point. They accidentally put in the furry vial.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah,
which, so, I don't know where to take that anymore.
Yeah.
I was, like, going to say three different jokes, but so, early on in the Genesis era, Sonic existed to sell the idea that the Genesis was this mature, cool, edgy console, you know, the one where you could play Mortal Kombat with blood,
yep.
But also, like, Sonic was way cooler than the middle-aged man fucking Mario. And I have my own sort of cultural observations about the way that campaign worked. It ultimately did work fairly well. You know, Genesis became a major console, and Sega had, I would say, relevant consoles somewhat. I mean, having the Saturn into the Dreamcast 1-2 punch was pretty bad.
Yeah, Sega petered out near the end, but you cannot say that they weren't a competitor through the era.
They definitely were. It was more so that they just became the blueprint that Sony used.
Yeah.
But sort of Sonic's incredibly hyper-focused marketing has been a mainstay since the beginning, and I think a big part of that is Sega of America and sort of the American market for Sonic. Like, Sonic the Hedgehog is the video game Bart Simpson, and I feel like that comparison means a lot, but it's that, like, he's similarly, like, countercultural, rad, cool, kind of nonchalant about a lot of things. Likes to skateboard, you know, likes going fast. And also, like, Bart Simpson became this marketing juggernaut of, like, everything had to be Bart Simpson. Fuck, there was a Bart Simpson commercial before The Simpsons came out. The fucking Butterfinger commercial. And do the Bartman. Remember when they had a Bart single? Like, early on, like, season one Simpsons, they had a Bart hit single.
Remember when the voice actress for Bart Simpson tried to get people to join Scientology by doing, you know, voice calls as Bart?
Yeah. But something about Bart that's always interesting is that Matt Groening has a notoriously loose stance on bootleg merchandise for The Simpsons. And this led to things like the Portlandia sketch of Bart Skompson, which is a fantastic sketch. I wish more people would reference that than the Brooklyn Nine-Nine ska joke. The Portlandia one always seemed to be more in with it than as, like, a pure punching bag. But anyways, it's really interesting, though, because, like, in a way, bootleg merchandise is still marketing, but other people are paying for it. Like, they're not getting the merchandising money, but they are still getting the notoriety of having an icon that is passed around.
Yeah.
Like, you might buy Bart merchandise that looks weird, and the money doesn't go to, you know, Fox or, you know, now Disney, who owns Fox, but you are still aware of Bart Simpson, and you're like, oh, I should watch The Simpsons. I'm a big Simpsons fan.
Yeah.
I'm going to buy seasons 4 through 12 on DVD.
But not the one that has the fucked up box.
Oh, I have that one on my shelf, actually.
Oh, God, it's disgusting.
Yeah. So I think Sonic is a very similar thing. There's always a lot of attention around Nintendo and how litigious there are with fan works. And always whenever that happens, people point to Sega with Sonic, being like, look how Sega treats Sonic. They let people make fan games and fan comics and, you know, all these other things. And they even hired fans. The Sonic Mania is a bit more complicated than what people say, because it's like they hired two fans for two other projects. And then they pitched the game Sonic Mania internally. But this like pattern of allowing things that are technically like breaking IP law, but they kind of don't care, has led to a huge Sonic fanworks community.
Yeah. It does feel like the two extremes are basically, you have the Nintendo side, which is like the design Bible side, where it's, you have to have everything very specifically on brand and controlled by Nintendo. And the moment that something, you know, steps outside of that, you have to pull out all the stops to make sure it doesn't happen again. We cannot have another Metroid 2 remake, because then people will say, where's a Metroid 2 remake? Meanwhile, then you have, you know, Sega, who are extremely laissez-faire with it, because the brand is ultimately, to them, better as a means of, like, getting the name out there and, like you said, you know, getting people to go, oh, Sonic, I haven't played a Sonic game in a while, I should see whatever the newest release is. Oh, it's Sonic Forces.
And the reason I brought up Sega of America is because they kind of already created fan works.
Yeah.
Like, think about how they had two Sonic cartoons running at the same time with completely different plots and characters. And they had the Sonic comic, which was kind of related to one of those cartoons, but also not. And then they gave Sonic two siblings who were also voiced by Steve Urkel.
Yeah.
That's Sonic Underground is beautiful, and that's like a whole other episode. But, I mean, it's not like there weren't Mario cartoons, because those were a big part of Mario in the 90s. But It feels like that has always been a feature of Sonic more so than Mario.
Yeah.
It almost feels like when Mario, like, weird offshoots like Super Show or the movie, the first movie come out, those feel like accidents. Whereas with Sonic, it's like par for the course. It's expected.
Yeah. It also leads to a sort of fractalization of lore, which, while I'm not going to get into it deeply, I do think that that's like one, I won't call it a weakness, but like, okay, when Disney bought Star Wars, the reason that they rebooted everything and just bisected it and said, this is the Old Republic, this is the Disney timeline, is because when you have a laissez-faire fan system, it's great, but it does mean that after a while you have this intangible web of lore that, like, some works agree with others and completely contradict others, to the point where, 20 years later, you have to put out a listing for a lore expert for your newest video game that's trying to tie all the lore together.
Okay, but it's not the laissez-faireness that's the issue, because Mario has the same problem. Do you know how many kingdoms border the Mushroom Kingdom? Do you know how many coastlines the Mushroom Kingdom has?
The difference there is that all of that is helmed directly by Nintendo, which means they're 100% at fault when it doesn't make any sense. Meanwhile, Sega can shrug their shoulders.
It's more so that the Sonic games have never adhered to a strict... Like, let's not forget Madonna. You remember Madonna?
Yeah, Madonna!
Remember Dr. Kintobor?
Oh, God.
Like, Sonic games have never had an adherence to a strict lore. Like, maybe you could say 1 through Knuckles, or sorry, 1 through and Knuckles is like, one storyline. And you could argue Adventure 1 and 2 are in the same universe, and I guess Shadow as well would be part of that. But even then, it's, like, not... And I can't go into the amount of Adventure 3s now.
Famously, there's, like, 7 different Sonic Adventure 3s, of course. But all this to say, as has been mentioned, Sega has a lot better policy towards fan works, or at the very least, a lot more open.
The way I sort of view it is that this is still part of the trendy, hip, and edgy Genesis Does mindset, but adapted for multiple eras. Because in the 2000s, you know, as the Dreamcast sort of petered out and died and nothing came of them, I feel like that's when the tools to make fan games started to become readily available, and it almost feels like in order to keep Sonic relevant, they allowed the burgeoning internet creator scene to really have their way with Sonic, for better or worse, because, like, they weren't doing great in the early 2000s. Sega was having some issues after 2 consoles kind of bombed in a row. And then nowadays, you see that with the Sonic Twitter account and just their sort of social media presence in general. And I think even then, the way they bring on fan creators like Tyson Hess or T-Lopes is, in a way, still the Genesis Does mindset. It is a way of staying hip and trendy, but instead of trying to look at, like, memes necessarily, it's more looking at the ways people communicate and the ways people experience things they like, even if that means it's not an experience entirely controlled by the company.
Yeah.
Fan works are an integral part of being a fan nowadays, and so why not encourage that, or at least, you know, look the other direction?
Yeah. Fandom is praxis. I've been brewing this for a while, but fandom is praxis. If it were up to Disney, Zootopia would have come out once, done, made all the money, and never been spoken of again.
And not have that one comic made,
but now there's 100,000 of that one comic.
Yeah.
Thanks, Disney.
How could you ruin the youth like that?
So yeah.
Judy Hopps really is the Rouge the Bat of the 2010s.
Judy Hopps dethroned Twilight Sparkle.
I can believe that.
Getting back on topic, I mean, this is a Sonic episode, yeah. so it's tangentially related.
Yeah, so all of this is to say that Sonic fan games are a big part of Sonic, and there, I think, is one fan game in particular that has stood the test of time and sort of stood out as, like, the thing. And of course, I'm talking about Sonic After the Sequel. No, I'm talking about Sonic Roboblast 2. So today we're talking about Robotnik's Ring Racers.
Yes, but to talk about that,
we have to go back in time into the fact corner.
The Fact Corner.
So, real quick, Robotnik's Ring Racer is a standalone released fan-made game that is a racer based in the Sonic universe, takes a lot of cues from primarily like Super Mario Kart and Mario Kart 64.
A lot of cues from Sonic Riders.
But that is the end product. To get to the end product, however, we have to go 20 years in the past.
Yeah, so, well, more than 20 years in the past.
Over 26 years.
Sonic Roboblast 2, released in 1998 as a mod of Legacy Doom, which was a port of Doom to Windows, which had a lot of features, with some of the more notable ones being multiple floors and jumping.
Yeah.
Isn't that wild to think that those weren't features in Doom?
Yeah, Doom, oh god.
We talked about this on the My House episode.
Yeah, I don't want to get into it too deeply, but like, as a refresher, Doom also is kind of a really interesting case of like, allowing the community to do whatever the hell they want. That was more in the period, like, that was, you know, that was the period of like, LAN parties and forums posting WADs and stuff. But it's interesting to compare them with the analysis we've just done of Sonic, I think.
Yeah. I want to note, as written by author Avery Ellis for the website Gizmodo, Sonic Roboblast 2 was the first 3D Sonic fan game, which is also kind of wild to think about, but then you remember it was 98. And also, I just want to note that the title of this article is like, the fan game that just won't die.
Yeah.
Because that's really how it feels. Sonic Roboblast 2 is still played. It was run by speedrunner Argic at SGDQ 2024.
It was updated in 24, I think like February.
Yeah, people still make tons of mods and custom content for the game. The main campaign has changed over the years, but also you can like, make, customize, and play as a ton of different custom characters. Gameplay-wise, it's also really weird because it feels like Sonic, but not like any 3D Sonic game. I would say the closest actual Sonic game to it is like Sonic Lost World. It is also how I feel like the canceled Sonic Extreme would have played.
That's the one that I was just thinking of, is like the Sonic Extreme, or like the 3D that was in like the Sonic Genesis collection or something.
Sonic Jam,
that's it.
Yeah. Sonic Extreme was a canceled Sonic game for, I want to say, the Sega Saturn. It might have been, I think it was Saturn, but it was canceled, but like, it looked like every level was shown through a fisheye lens. It was really weird looking. You can find footage on it. It's a pretty famous, like, canceled prototype.
Yeah.
And it may have been sabotaged by Yuji Naka?
It may have been sabotaged by Yuji Naka, and I believe it also nearly led to the deaths of one of the developers who like overworked on it very badly.
Yeah, there's definitely like a whole book there. I don't know if there is an actual book, but I would read it. But anyway, Sonic Roboblast 2 is weird because like, it doesn't play like adventure games. It kind of plays like the previous like Sonic 3, Sonic 2 style, but it is 3D. It's a lot of running and platforming, and you accelerate really fast, and it kind of controls like a shooter. I mean, that all makes sense because it's based off Doom, but like, I can't get over how weird of a Sonic game it is, but also it still somehow feels like Sonic in a way that even some Sonic games don't.
Yeah.
Like, it's like if Sonic 06 worked and also was made in Doom. But SRB2 has a huge modding scene, and this led to, you know, forks upon forks and custom game modes.
Oh. Also, by the way, there was an SRB1. It is not materially significant to this story.
Yeah,
like,
don't worry about
it. There was a game that was Sonic Roboblast. Sonic Roboblast 2 then got created in 98 and is the important one here.
Yeah.
So, just for clarity, that's why this is SRB2.
Yeah. So, in 2011, though, a modder by the name of Chaos064, which is a great name, released SRB2 Riders, which was a fan mod of Sonic Roboblast 2, which is a fan mod of Doom Legacy, which is a port of Doom. And Sonic SRB2 Riders was like porting the mechanics of Sonic Riders to SRB2. Sonic Riders being the official racing game on GameCube, Wii. We don't talk about the Kinect one. There was not a third one.
there is a third one. It's SRP2.
Sure, but it was like a hoverboard racing game. It's great. I love it. Shout out to the Sonic Riders competitive community. you can play as Hatsune Miku.
Yep. And Ulala.
Well, she's in the base game.
She was in the base game.
That was released in 2011, and it also came with a Sonic SRB2 karting, like, side game mode. The SRB2 kart game mode wasn't a focus of the mod, but it was there. And that sowed the seeds for SRB2 kart, which released in 2021 as a fork of SRB2 Riders, which was a fan mod of Sonic Robo Blast 2, which was a fan mod of Doom Legacy, which was a port of Doom. And SRB2 kart is developed by a team known as Kart Crew, crew being spelt with a K, which consists of many members of the SRB2 modding scene. This was a huge project.
Yep.
And even at this point, SRB2 Kart was still released as a standalone executable. Like, you didn't have to download Doom and then Legacy Doom and then, like, go through the patching steps and load in stuff. And all of it was just an executable. So that was pretty good. SRB2 Kart still had a pretty big modding scene, especially with custom characters. There was capabilities for other things like custom stages or custom items. We'll get to all that later. But this year in 2024, they surprise dropped a sequel, a new standalone executable game with way too much in it, known as Dr. Robotnik's Ring Racers. Now, this game is great. Okay.
So, all right. Not SRB2 Kart.
Ring Racers. Ring Racers. I said it.
Yeah, we said it. You said it. I'm not taking any credit or blame. Robotnik's Ring Racers is a kart racing game that functions, as I said earlier, closer to, like, Super Mario Kart or Mario Kart 64 in terms of, like, game feel and kart feel. It is a kart racer, so if you have played a Mario Kart or maybe, like, a Crash Team Racing, you are probably decently comfortable with it. But the basic here is that all characters have two stats, weight and speed. High speed means low acceleration. High weight means...
High weight is better off-roading, but worse handling.
Yep. And high speed means low acceleration. And I think also that affects your, like, mini boosts a little bit.
But I think it also gives you higher top speed.
Yep. So every character is just 1 to 9 on those two. So literally any character is just two numbers.
Displayed in a Sudoku grid.
Yes, displayed in a Sudoku grid, which also means that, like, that is a big reason, I think, as to why the modding scene for SRB2 Kart specifically kind of blew up, because it's very easy to make a character for it.
Mm-hmm.
But you have the ability to drift, you have the ability to use items. The main thing, like, if you are looking for the main difference between this and Mario Kart, it is probably the rings. So Mario Kart has coins. Mario Kart 8 has coins, specifically, the most recent one. You collect them to get a higher top speed. It's a little boring. Rings are actually a really interesting little system where if you don't have an item in your slot, if you don't have an item that you can use, you can tap the use item button, the left trigger, to consume a ring or two. You have a maximum of 20, and it will give you a little speed boost. And so it adds a lot of really interesting decision-making, because a lot of lines in the stages will be chock-a-block full of rings with the explicit intention of going, hey, if you use rings along this section, you'll get a lot of speed boost and still have full rings.
Yeah, so this is really important because it plays into the, like, Sonic origins of this.
Yep.
Sonic origins. So Ring Racers is interesting because most kart racers, it feels like, if you are on an uphill section, you won't, like, slide down pretty severely. Like, you won't get super stuck in the course. You can in Ring Racers.
Yeah,
even in pretty early courses in terms of, like, unlocks.
Yeah, it is very momentum-based.
Exactly.
Which, like, perfect theming.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Yeah, to keep the Sonic feeling of, like, momentum being crucial, it is that there's a lot of momentum-based mechanics where you, like, need to keep a certain speed to go up hills, and so sometimes you might need to expend a few rings to get enough speed to really go up a hill at a decent pace. Higher weight characters have an easier time going off-road, but that can be made even easier by using rings or any other speed boost.
Yep.
There is, like, a lot of aerial shortcuts where it revolves around getting enough speed going into a jump. And in order to do that, you often have to sort of finagle yourself.
Yep.
It's not that rings are the only way to boost. As you mentioned, there are items. One of the items, the speed shoe, is essentially a mushroom.
Yeah.
There's other items that provide boosts as well, like the fire shield. But also, like, if you are going down a steep enough downhill slope, you will just gather enough speed to, like, go off-road for a second.
Yes. So, one of the bespoke interesting things, the speed upgrades, the mushrooms, or the star equivalent, the course has shortcuts that are, like, hard set by, like, electric barriers that can only be passed either with getting enough speed to get, like, enough speed to get in the state, which doesn't happen often.
When you go fast enough, there's this, like, blue shield that appears in front of you to show all the wind just slipping past you.
Yep. It's not a blue cross, though. Fuck the blue cross. It's a blue cross, blue shield joke.
I get it.
Anyway, the like, electric barriers can be passed if you have the speed shoe, if you have the mushroom. And so, like, doing so will often actively cut off parts of the course. Like, for example, usually you might have to go along, like, a spiral down, and it's, you know, three spirals that you have to go down. But there might just be a gate that if you have the mushroom, you just speed past it, don't even have to do this entire section. So that's a very fun little, like, catch-up mechanic, because you are not going to get... You're not going to get any speed boosts in first place.
Yeah,
you barely get them in, like, second and third.
There's a lot of items that can do it. There's, like, the mushrooms, the invincibility, like you said. They have the top from Marble Garden Zone.
Yeah.
Which controls, like, I don't remember the name of it, but it's the green crystal-looking warp star from Kirby Air Ride. But it's one where, like, you can't turn, you can only change your direction by holding drift. It's great, but it also sucks, but it's also great. There's also, like, a big mode attack that makes you big, and there's two ways to reach the big state, but in either one you can go through the shortcuts. It's really cool. And I think the flame shield can also send you through if you use the flame shield boost.
Yeah.
The course design is, I think, really good. There's a lot of variety in terms of what is actually challenged. Like, for the most part, you will find your typical kart racer stuff of, like, this has a lot of straightaways with some obstacles in it. This has a lot of, like, hairpin turns. This one makes it hard to drift because the turns kind of snake back and forth. This one has a fucked up elevator ride. This one has sharks. There's underwater portions where you control a little differently. There are a few, like, flipping gravity sections, and they all suck. Partially because the camera doesn't flip, and it's not meant to render that way.
Yeah.
The courses come in a lot of variety because there's typical, like, three-lap courses. There's some that are bigger, so they only have two laps. There's some that are straightaways where you do one long lap through the course. There are some that are tiny and have five laps. And, of course, they have a baby park, which has, like, nine laps.
Yep, they have the baby park, the best course.
Yeah. Going back a bit to the rings, though, much like Sonic, rings are kind of a lifeline. In that if you have no rings and you get hit, you are, like, you like, do a tumble. You're stuck in your tracks. You, like, explode.
You get carted.
Yeah. But if you do have rings and you get hit, you only go into, like, a bit of hit stun. And there's, like, you're slowed down a bit, but you have iframes. It's safer.
Yeah.
So there is sort of a risk reward to spending all of your rings versus saving a few. It is very easy to accidentally spend more rings than you think, though.
Yes. God, yes. One of the interesting things is that if somebody gets an item plate, it doesn't completely go away. It becomes replaced with a, like, silver item box rather than a gold one, which all have different coin rewards, which honestly are sometimes more useful.
Bro, like, I called them coins.
Oh, shit. I think you mean rings. Those look nothing like the coins from Sonic. You get ring rewards, and honestly, most of the time, they are more useful than the items you can get.
You can just hold the item button the whole time you're getting the rings, because you'll get more than 20.
Yeah.
It's whenever you get any item box or item bubble or balloon, it creates a little slot machine in your item window, and you have to manually stop it when you want the item that shows up.
Yeah.
So there's, like, a skill element to getting items. Obviously, if you're in first, you're not going to get things like the shrink ray or the marble garden top, but you're going to get more, like, defensive items. But still, you can have some influence over which one you get. And then for the ring rewards, they go from like 10 rings to 20 rings to 30. And then there's like a jackpot, which gives you like 100 or something.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, 10, 20, 30, 50, 100 or something like that.
Yeah. And so you're able to get a lot of rings if you time it correctly. But sometimes you might have to wait to do so. And like, you might not have enough time because there's a, you know, an off-road section coming up that you need the speed for.
Yep. Okay. Two things that are foundational to this game that are things that I love. Number one, this game has like 200 courses.
It's so many.
It's that does include the like bonus areas. Even without the bonus stuff, even without the stuff that you personally would probably not call a course, it has 150 fucking courses.
Yeah.
Like, it's insane. And the like the various Grand Prix that they have, a couple of them do reuse like individual courses. They rarely ever do it more than once. It's like, you know, sometimes you'll find one course in a couple of cups, but more often than not, it is all new courses.
They don't repeat courses. They repeat themes. They'll have like sequels to existing themes.
Okay.
So like there's the Dark Moon Castle in Dark Moon Castle 2, which have different layouts, but they are the same Dark Moon Castle theme.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. They don't repeat courses like that, though.
Even more credence to my, like, Super Mario Kart comparison, honestly. Yeah.
So, just for reference, every cup in Grand Prix mode has 7 courses. There are 5 race courses, 2 battle courses. The battle courses have, like, a break the targets mode. It's really cool. There are, let's see, it's a row of 6 courses, or 6 cups. And then after you beat that, you unlock the second row of 6 cups. Then after you beat that, you unlock another screen of 24 cups. And that's not even the end of it.
Yeah.
So, like,
it's 12 cups, actually. I believe it's, like, 10 or 12 cups per... Like, it's you know, 10, like 12 cups on top, and then you unlock the second row. And then, like you said, you unlock the second screen that has
there's
another
no,
24.
Okay, maybe it's 8 and 8, but there's no way it's 12 in a row.
I think it might be, like, 10.
You know what? We're gonna have to look this up later.
Yeah. This is a little homework for the audience to figure out.
Yeah, this is a practice, an exercise for the viewer.
This will be on the worksheet that you're taking home for homework.
Yeah.
The second thing that I love, the visuals of this game, like, number one, really, really good. Just really, really, like, interesting and visually diverse. I like the 2D sprites. But all of the character designs are specifically like meant to be older character designs. It's meant to be like the Sonic classic
look. They have green dress Amy, for example. Yeah. It's like any characters who were in Sonic R have the Sonic R design, and then otherwise it tends to be the earliest design for the character.
Yeah, I like, you know, specifically I love that Robotnik is the egg design, the very, you know, classic round boy design.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, like you said, they have the green dress Amy, they have the, like, classic Sonic and classic Tails. The opening to the game, the, like, tutorial section is also a really cute, heartwarming little thing of, like, Robotnik and Tails working together to, you know, finalize the kart racer, basically.
Yeah.
Really adorable. But
I want to mention that the sound bite they use for every time Eggman talks is the sound of him jumping in Sonic Adventure 2. He goes, "Heel!"
It's really, like, it's really good. Yeah, visually, I love the design of the characters. The courses are also really, really diverse. Some of them are, like, directly inspired by a lot of the, like, bonus stages or just other, you know, other obvious Sonic stages.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot that are just Sonic levels, like Emerald Coast, Green Hill Zone, Emerald Hill Zone.
There is one that is literally just the opening to Sonic Adventure 2.
There's an entire cup based off of the two-player versus stages from Sonic 3 and Knuckles.
Because of this as well, visually, a lot of the courses, like, range a lot of different, you know, they're all two-dimensional, like, you know, they're all three-dimensional planes made out of two-dimensional building blocks, but they have incredible variety of, like, sometimes it is specifically a lot more, like, Genesis inspired, sometimes it's, like, very flat colors and, like, early 3D. Sometimes it just is, you know, like a beautiful beach lakeside that I don't even think is from one of the games. It's just incredible. Like, visually speaking, this game looks fun to play.
I think the way I would describe it is that this is essentially just the Doom art style that has been kept in place over time throughout many iterations because it is viewed as an essential part of the Sonic Robo-Blast 2 experience.
Yeah.
It's like you take the tile sets from old Sonic games and just put those as textures onto the, like, polygons, but the polygons themselves are very, like, low detail because it's Doom.
Yeah. Like, it's a lot of boxy platforms.
Yeah, a lot of boxy straight lines. When there are curves, sometimes you can see just, like, the flat line planes that make up the curve. It's kind of beautiful in a way. I love it. I love it whenever, like, indie games use this style as well. All the characters are 2D sprites, obviously.
Yep.
Well, maybe not obviously, but they're 2D sprites. And so it has the, like, Paper Mario aspect. Or just something they did in the 64 era a lot, where, like, you have a 2D sprite that is pretty detailed in animation over a super boxy and blocky terrain.
Yeah.
But it kind of doesn't look out of place because the sprite itself maintains the pixelated blockiness. It's an interesting art style that I think is often seen nowadays as part of the low-poly renaissance. I feel like if you were to look at, like, Bunlith's sort of PSX Lilith's, like, art style, that's sort of similar in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
A lot of it is attributed to, like, PS1 art style, but it's not necessarily entirely PS1.
Yeah. Visually, I love it.
And yeah, theme-wise, it's great.
Yeah, thematically, it's great. The writing, what little writing there is very charming. Yeah.
I want to bring up, so as a longtime Sonic fan, there are a lot of good pulls. A big thing is just for characters, there's a lot of good pulls.
Yep.
Like, they have Big, they have Charmy and Espio, but not Vector. For some reason, they couldn't put Vector in the game.
Well, Vanilla's not in the game either. Not Vanilla.
Vanilla.
Yeah,
Cream's Vanilla. Mom.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, I made a good Sonic reference.
Yeah, Vanilla's Cream's mom. Yep, they should put her in the game. She can drive.
She can drive. She's old enough.
Cream doesn't have a license, I'm sorry. I don't think they have Cosmo. I kind of wish they put Cosmo in there. She's great. Love her. They have... I wonder if they're just afraid to put in, like, some of the Sad AM and Archie characters, because they don't have Bunny the Rabbit or Antoine, but, like...
Like, come on.
They do have Sonic the Fighters characters. They have Bark, Bean, Fang. They have Honey the Cat, who isn't even a Sonic the Fighters character. She's a Fighting Vipers character who is Sonic-fied.
I believe Fang is actually one of the default characters, too, which is fun and interesting.
Yeah. They have Mighty and Ray. So they have Mecha and Metal Sonic. They have Tails Doll in the oft-forgotten Mecha Knuckles.
Yeah, I was about
from
to
Sonic
say.
R. Everyone's like, oh my god, Tails Doll. And then, oh my god, Metal Sonic. And they forget the third guy.
Yeah, the other guy.
Yeah. I don't think they have Omega or Gamma, which is also weird. They have Eggman robots playable, but
yeah.
I don't think they have Omega or Gamma, who are the actual playable Eggman robots.
That is actually another thing, is that they have a number of the Eggman robots available, like the fucking wheel bug. They have the bomb.
Mm-hmm.
Again, real good pulls, real good pulls.
Yeah, overall, I'd say real good pulls. And then they have a lot of guest characters just in base. This is ignoring, by the way, the hundreds of modded characters people have made. But they have guest characters, which include other, like, Sega games, like Vector Man, Dynamite Heady. They have a character, I believe, from Idolmaster. They have a character from Sakura Wars. They have Arl from Puyo. They have Wonder Boy from Wonder Boy. By the way, it's Arl from, like, Puyo 1 specifically.
Yeah!
Not, like, her Puyo Fever and Up design, like the modern Arl, which I would personally love to see. Or just any other Puyo character, like Reese Kuma
or
Ringo.
Carbuncle.
Give me Amity. Give me Shizo. Make him say weird things. give me Allie. Puyo's great. But they have all these guest characters. They have guest courses as well. Like, they have, you unlock the Soccer Wars character by playing on the Soccer Wars theater stage.
Nice.
I'm trying to think, what are some of the other really good ones? They have an Idolmaster, or they have, like, an Idol stage. I think it's Idolmaster. I could be wrong on that. Don't quote me.
The only other Idol thing I've ever watched is Love Live, and not Oshinoko. I don't consider that an Idol thing.
Yeah.
That's a very active watch.
I watched Glee for a bit.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Glee is essentially Love Live before Love Live.
It's... I No. I refuse to yes and this.
No, it's so true, though.
Oh, God.
People are against it.
they rejected his message because he spoke the truth.
Just like how Ted Lasso is a sports anime. That one might be more palatable.
That one I could accept.
Yeah. The Bear is not a cooking anime, though. There's not enough people coming from eating food. We're too off track. Fucking, they have Bubsy as a racer.
Oh, God.
You can play as Bubsy.
You can play as Bubsy.
Yeah. That's a great... He's unlockable. They have Carol from Freedom Planet, but not the other two.
They have Surge, of course.
They have Surge. Yeah, Surge they do is, have some...
Surge has had a surge in popularity.
Well, they do have some, like, extra canon, like, comics characters, because they also have Whisper.
Yep, yep.
I don't know much about the comics themselves, but I like those two characters.
My current main is the Chow, which is the 1-1, the 1 speed and 1 weight.
Yeah, So they have, like, multiple CCs, essentially, multiple speeds and difficulties, and when I play on, like, normal... the essentially 150cc, I play Metal Knuckles. But when I play on Vicious, which is the, like, 200cc, I haven't quite found a character I like, but I've been mainly playing Carol or Rouge. Game's really cool. The other big thing that I love about this game, there are so many unlockables.
Yes!
So, this is one of the big things.
One of the best things.
One of the best mechanics in Brawl, in Kirby Air Ride by extension, is the unlock system, where they have a list of, like, challenges in a grid, and each challenge unlocks a new thing, but also, once you've completed X amount of challenges, you get a free pass to clear one of the challenges, whichever one you want, and you get the reward. It's a great system because it lets you see unlock requirements, even ones that are, like, super obscure. It lets you plan around them. It has a fun, like, bubble wrap aspect of, like, you see a blank screen full of bubbles and you get stuff when you pop them, and so you want to pop them all and fill in everything. And the, like, key aspect of unlocking keys, which let you unlock achievements for free, is great for, like, people who don't want to, like, do the hardest difficulty but want to get the unlocks from doing that.
Yep.
Or, like, they have a lot of collectibles in the game that take time to get, and you can just fast forward through some of that by using the keys. It's a great system that I wish more games did.
It's so, yeah, it's such an inspired choice because, like...
the Sakurai prize wall.
The game has a lot of unlockables. It also has essentially, like, a, not a tournament mode, but, like, an option that allows you to just temporarily unlock everything. Just, I'm playing multiplayer with friends. Give
I'm
me
pretty
everything.
Sure it is called tournament mode.
It
because
well
it's meant
be.
For local gameplay. Rivals has this as well, yeah. Actually, where you input a cheat code and it lets you unlock everything so that people can play, like, fair.
Yeah.
You don't have to unlock everything through story mode in order to have a tournament set up.
Yep, but, like, the process of unlocking is just so plainly fun. Like, because the other thing, too, is you get keys at a really reasonable
yeah.
You get one after every 5 races, which, if you'll notice, 5 races is a Grand Prix.
Yeah.
So, like, you get one every Grand Prix, and there are some unlockables that are, like, big unlockables. They're, like, double wide. They take 10 keys if you want to unlock them via keys.
Ah, Fire Formation 10 key.
So, like, it's such a good system.
Yeah.
And I'm so happy to see it in something that A, is modern, and B, has so fucking much to unlock.
I want to shout out some of the unlockables. So, like, there are some where you have to do sort of obscure things to unlock a character. My favorite was if you destroy every table in the mall level, you unlock Billy Hatcher.
Ha!
I don't really know what eggs have to do with that. Maybe it's because it's like in the game when you roll over shit with your giant egg.
Yeah.
And then you go, ooh, cook-a-doo-doo-doo. It's a great game. But then every level has a spray can, which is usually put in a tricky spot to reach that often requires either like an item or taking a particular shortcut. Sometimes there's interactables, like a switch you have to hit with an item that you throw to like open a door.
Yeah.
And the spray cans unlock new colors. There's a lot of alternate colors.
There's a lot of alternate colors for, like, there is alternate colors for everyone.
Yeah, you can use the alternate colors for everyone is the thing.
And it's like, it's not just, you know, oh, seven different colors for Roy G. Biv or anything. There's like, there are, one of the earliest unlocks I got was just a random spray can that was like, unlock 86 spray cans. Like, there's 150 levels, and, you know, assuming that there aren't any repeats. Well, I mean, I guess there aren't any repeats in the total number of levels. Point being, there's 150 levels, there's 150 spray cans.
Yep. Yeah, it's a lot. And then also, okay, I love this. There are some challenges that say to play the Mystic Melody in a certain course. The Mystic Melody is a mechanic in Sonic Adventure 2, where every character has a secret unlockable hidden in one of the levels. That's like an upgrade that lets you play a tune at a shrine that is on every level. And the shrine is usually kind of tucked away, kind of hidden, and it always opens up a secret passage to where you get the Lost Chow for the Lost Chow mission. In this game, so they have buddies, which are like little followers that follow you. Duh.
Yeah. A lot of them are like enemies from Sonic.
Yeah, they like fly behind you. They kind of move around you. And then when you honk your horn by looking backwards, they do a little jig. But one of the followers you get is the Mystic Melody, which is hidden in a level in like a little upgrade circle like in Sonic Adventure 2, which is great. It's also like one of the last levels on the first page that you unlock it. So it's sort of a like mid to late game unlockable. It's like unfolding more of the game to you. Like, yeah, you've reached this far, you've achieved this much, now there's a whole new level of secrets to do. And the Mystic Melody shrines are often more hidden than the paint cans by far. There's some in really cool spots and really interesting spots to reach. But, like, just having the Mystic Melody, for one thing, was really cool. As, like, you know, a pretty big fan of Sonic Adventure 2, that was just something I was really happy to see. But the way it's integrated into the secret hunting is also really cool and well done, and there's, like, a lot to explore, which I always like. It's weird because, like, racing games are literally meant to go from point A to point B fast, but I like it when racing games have things to explore. That was always a big highlight of the SSX series for me.
Yeah.
Like, I wanted to bring this up when we mentioned the electro tape you pass through for shortcuts, but it kind of reminds me of the big glass signs in SSX that yeah, are like, hey, there's clearly a shortcut here, go this way. And some shortcuts in SSX required you to use your boost at the time. That's the other thing I was going to mention, which is that the rings are like boost in SSX and in turn in Sonic Riders and also in Downhill Jam, which is really interesting. Boosting mechanics in board-based racing games. One of my favorite bits in any video game, in Wave Race on the GameCube, there is a level set in like Thailand or something, but in free play mode, at the start of the level, there's a little pathway you can take to the left. And in that pathway, you come to this, like, temple with elephants around it. Yeah. It's a little spot that you can't get to through, like, the normal race. And yeah, I think it's blocked off during the normal race. But they put it there as just a thing for you to find. And I love that. And it feels like there's a lot of that in Ring Racers, especially for the purpose of hiding things like the paint cans or the Mystic Melody shrines. It's this environmental design that's like, look, people are going to take the fastest route, but that doesn't mean that's all we have to put in here. We can put other stuff here, even if it's not the fastest route.
Yeah.
And I super respect that. It's also like Royal Raceway on Mario Kart 64 that has the Princess Peach's castle that just exists.
Yeah, the best N64 level. Because you can just go to Peach's castle and just be there. And it's like from Mario 64.
Yeah.
Love it.
There's so many cool little bits in Ring Racers. I did want to just go over the items really quick before we go to your thing. So items, we mentioned the speed shoes. We mentioned the marble garden top. We mentioned invincibility. The attack items, there's the Orbinauts, which are spike balls that kind of work like green shells. You throw them. I don't think they bounce. They hit the target that they aim for. You have to aim them. There's the Jaws, which are the sharks from Sonic 3. And those are homing attacks.
Those are your red shell.
Mm-hmm. There are a few, like, trap items where you can hold them behind you or you can throw them ahead of you. There's the banana, which acts exactly like Mario Kart bananas. There's the bumper, which when collided with while it's on the ground, you like bump in the opposite direction from it really quickly.
Yeah. It's like a pinball bumper.
Exactly, yeah. There is the Eggman box, which is the worst one. It's a fake item box that when you hit it, it starts at like a 5 second countdown.
Yeah.
And you can hot potato it by like hitting other racers.
It's a really fun item, but I cannot tell you how many times I've like I've seen it and gone, that's a fake item box. I need to dodge it. And then, like, just because of the way I'm drifting or what have you, I hit it, and I'm like, well,
yeah,
fuck me, I guess.
It does create an explosion that can hurt nearby racers, so even if you're not fast enough to, like, run into somebody to pass it off to them, you can still inconvenience other racers.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, there's a ghost item which steals items from the person that runs by it.
Yep.
There's the three elemental shields from Sonic 3, and I totally forgot to mention this. So the controls for the game, there's the usual drifting, and you drift and you get mini turbos the longer you drift.
Yep.
We mentioned the rings. There's two other ways to gain speed, which are, there's a spin dash, which is sort of a brake, but if you're not moving and you hold the button, you start up a spin dash, which can go like up to a countdown of four, with the four being like go. And whenever you let go, you gain a burst of speed based on that time. But if you, like, completely slow down from getting hit by an item, you can usually charge up the spin dash a bit to get a good amount of speed to return to the race.
Yeah.
There's also the emergency slingshot, which I don't even really use. It's sort of weird.
I also don't use it.
It essentially is the same as ringing out and then respawning closer to the rest of the pack.
Yeah.
But it creates, like, a little platform other people can jump off of. I don't know. It's a weird one.
I would also like to say that something we didn't mention earlier is when you have zero coins, your left button, your, like, item button.
Coins.
I keep fucking calling them coins. I have Mario Kart on the mind, unfortunately, and I don't know why. It's not like we're talking about Mario Kart.
Yeah.
Anyway. If you have no rings, holding the item button charges up a little, like, it's a little, like, shockwave. Yeah, a little spin attack that will hurt other people and make them drop their coins. Holding it for too long will make you lose coins. It's, like, down to negative 10 or something. So you don't want to just purposely, you know, keep holding it. But it's important to note that even if you have literally nothing else, you do still have an offensive option. The game likes to consistently give you options.
Yeah. So the only other thing I wanted to mention is if you press the spin dash button in midair, you do a ground pound, which also has a little jump if you're high enough.
Yep.
It's like a little boing. And sometimes that can actually help you. That bounce can go over like pits or like very small pits at least, or it can go over bits of off-road. But so going back and then back forward a bit to the elemental shields, one of them is the water shield, which in Sonic 3 allows Sonic to, like, ground bounce by pressing A in midair. You fall down really quick and then boing off.
Yep.
If you use that in Ring Racers by doing the, like, ground pound, you gain a big amount of forward momentum. Like,
yeah.
It converts your downward to forward, which is great and in tone with it and adds a lot of interesting depth to courses that have a lot of, like, drops or airtime. There's also the lightning shield, which picks up rings, magnetizes them, and you can press the item button to do a big shockwave around you. And then also there's the flame shield, which I mentioned, gives you a boost, but you can also use it in midair to sort of glide for a bit.
Yeah.
They're super... Oh, and there's the spring, which is just a spring that lets you jump.
Yeah, it's the feather.
Yeah, but, like, they're... That lets you do a lot of, like, shortcuts, or
yeah.
There's spray cans you need the spring for. It's like the items in general are very open-ended with a lot of possibilities. That's also not to mention you can use the bumper to run into it yourself.
Yeah.
Which
I have multiple times, like, regained ground by just kind of, like, really quickly noticing the bumper and using it in a way that helps me.
If you are in first and you throw the jaws, it will target you. But that means you can do things where you damage boost off of it to, like, do certain things. There's one level where, like, there is a jump with two springs, and then those hit a pillar that has springs on either side, and then you do, like, a forking, like, U-turn, but you can skip some of that by getting hit in midair which makes it so you don't hit the pillar with the two springs.
Yeah.
And I was like, I wonder if you could do an IL strat where you intentionally hit yourself with a shark.
The last two items that I personally want to mention are, one, the self-propelled bomb. It's the blue shell equivalent. It's interesting because it very consistently stays behind the player in first place. But if they are fast enough, if they can outrun it...
You pretty much have to maintain a higher than normal speed through a mix of rings and mini turbos.
Yeah, it's something where you can, if you have the skill and a little bit of luck, you can completely outrun it and stay in front of it. But, like, you know, it is also a thing of, like, if you really mess up or slow down once, then it gets you.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is the grow slash shrink ray, primarily shrink ray. It's the equivalent of the lightning, and what it does is, when you activate it, it brings out a whole bunch of, like lasers that go back and forth on the track. If it hits you, you grow big. If you're the one who activated it, you're the one, you grow big.
You grow,
congratulations.
Girl.
If it hits anyone else, they grow small. And it doesn't last the longest, but, like, the smallification doesn't last the longest, but the laser lasts so fucking, it's like 30 seconds of the laser just constantly being there.
Yeah, they're pretty regularly spaced. You can dodge them.
Yeah.
Like, you can swerve around the laser if you time it right. But if you are on a line where you get hit by one, you'll probably get hit by at least a few more.
Yeah.
If not the rest of them.
Yeah, it's one of the lesser... It's one of my least favorite items in the game.
Yeah. It's interesting. It's a type of item design that I think prioritizes counterplay. So, like, the blue shell has counterplay here. The lightning has counterplay. And it's not to say they don't have counterplay in Mario Kart 8, but... Usually the counterplay for those are just items. The star technically beats the lightning, the music box beats blue shell, but those are a lot harder to use consistently because it's just item luck.
The foundational, like, the design of Robotnik's Ring Racer and the previous versions by extension seems primarily focused on, like, essentially high skill ceiling of, like, if you play good enough, if you can kart good enough, kart hard enough, you can outrun and dodge a lot of the projectiles. There's some that you can't, but, like, you know, it's a kart racer. There should be a couple that are a lot harder to dodge.
Usually when I lose pretty badly, like beyond third or fourth place, I can tell where I messed up exactly.
Yeah.
It is definitely high skill ceiling, but also a little high skill floor.
Yeah.
Higher than a lot of kart games.
Unfortunately, the fact that this game has a pretty high skill floor kind of means that I don't necessarily like this game. Oh,
yeah.
Shit! It's the mid-review turnaround!
Mid-review? We gotta end this soon.
Yeah, it's more like the three-quarters review turnaround. The four-fifths review turnaround.
Yeah.
Alright, so...
The 11th hour.
So, alright, I've been holding back. Unfortunately, I have found myself in a very unfortunate situation where I appreciate... so much of this fucking game, I kind of hate playing this game. So, okay, a little background. I'm willing to admit that a lot of this is kind of just, I am not yet good at the game. It hasn't clicked for me. I also had, you know, I also didn't strictly like Mario Kart 8 for a hot while until I got better at it. So it makes sense. The problem... So much of the game is skill-based, and it kind of gets into that weird period where it's like, I am somebody who is not good enough to do competitive, but too good to do casual, you know, in a lot of different scenarios.
Heartbreaking.
Yeah, I know. I'm too good for my friends who don't play video games and too bad for my friends who do. And so because of that, I'm in that really awkward skill period where, like, gear 1, 100cc is fine, I can perfectly do it. Gear 2 is so much harder. And gear 3 I haven't even tried. I'm not even going to try 200cc until much later.
And gear 4, Bound Man, oh boy.
And gear 5, if I knew good anime references, I know that gear is a thing in one of them.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. That's what I was doing. That's what my reference was. If you know, you know.
Yeah.
If you know one of the most popular anime in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, unfortunately, I found myself in a very awkward position where I appreciate so much of what this game is from a little bit of a distance. I'm probably going to continue playing it. I'm probably going to continue... At the very least, the single-player content is amazing. Like, I do think that this game... this game is worthwhile exclusively as a single-player game. And the fact that it is, you know, primarily a multiplayer experience, essentially, that adds to it. The fact that it was something that was made primarily as multiplayer-facing, that, you know, because of that, it was primarily a lot more skill-based, and a lot of stuff was made with that in mind. But the Robotnik's Ring Racer release added so much in the terms of single-player, which I think is great because I'm willing to bet that it's primarily a means of onboarding new players,
yeah,
more or less. It's, you know, you play all the Grand Prix once to get the familiarity, and then you go to multiplayer. And because there's so much in the single player, you can bounce between them very, very frequently. I respect this game. I love this game. But I fucking hate playing this game. I have gotten carded so... terribly and so many times. There's so many, like I said, I hate the lightning equivalent. I hate the laser. There's so many courses that like do specific momentum things that feel like I'm not in control. Anything that has like a big ramp that you go up, I knock down a couple of points in it internally. Yeah, it's, and the problem is that I fundamentally don't think this is a problem with the end product.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think this is any problem with Robotnik's Ring Racer. They don't need to add a gear 0.5. But, like, it's just it's a problem insofar as I wonder if this will actually bridge the gap between a, like, more casual player and a more competitive player. That doesn't need to be its job. It doesn't have to do that. It could have been entirely made for not me, and that's fine.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, it seems made at least a little bit with, like, you know, newer players in mind. And I respect that. I love it. I love the game. I love the team who's made it. I just don't know if I enjoy playing the game in a setting that isn't, like, you know, couch co-op.
So, I think this is sort of the... big critical, what's the word, like, a lot of people view criticism entirely as a criticism of the work itself and the creators of that work. And while most of the time criticism is, oftentimes criticism can be more a recognition that the work is different than sort of your expectations, or in this case your preferences.
Yeah.
And that is not a diss against the work. I think it's that, like, it feels like you wish you could enjoy it more, but you can't.
Yeah.
And that difference is what's rough, I guess. Yeah. It's like, I would be more critical of, like, I don't know, a game that has really good art style and music, but, like, the gameplay sucks, because I would want to like it, but I can't like it.
Yeah.
It's something like that, I think. I really like Ring Racers. This is perfect for me. I am a very competitive person. I love optimization. I love the feeling of, like, learning new skills and incorporating them. Ring Racers has a lot of things I like about speedrunning. And, I mean, I played a lot of 200cc Mario Kart 8, so, like, a lot of the speed management really works for me. Like, there's a lot about braking that you don't think about through most of Mario Kart that is very important in Mario Kart, in 200cc for Mario Kart 8. But is also very important in multiple difficulties of Ring Racers. Braking a little as you're going around a curve or stuff like that. And then also being able to approach shortcuts in off-road sections the way 200 uses no mushroom shortcuts, I think helped me a lot.
Yeah.
But I can also recognize that that is a very spiky playstyle to use the Rosewater psychographic profiles. And it's not to say that you're not spiky enough or that you aren't spiky in that regard, but I think it's a difference in preference or playstyle, like I said.
Yeah.
And I can totally also get that, like, all the single player content feels like it's there for casuals, but at the same time the course design and the physics mechanics don't necessarily reflect that. I almost wonder, What if there was, like, a cruise control setting that said, like, use rings to keep at a certain speed so that when you go uphill, it would automatically spend enough rings to, like, keep your speed?
Yeah.
It would make certain things harder and give you less control, but maybe that's, like, an accessibility thing that could be done. They have, like, automatically stop the item slot machine, and I think they have a few other auto options. Maybe they already have an automatically spend rings option. I don't know. But I get what you're saying, because it did take a long time for me to get used to. The other big thing that took me a long time to get used to was the way drifting works, in that in Mario Kart, after you drift, you sort of keep the momentum from turning, but in Ring Racers, it feels more like when you drift and then you let go, all your momentum from, like, the side is instead converted to forward momentum in the direction you're now facing.
Yeah.
Which means you can take certain curves much tighter, but it's just a really different approach to drifting than what I'm used to.
Yeah. The reason that I keep bringing up Super Mario Kart and Mario Kart 64's comparison points is because I think it lends more towards that style insofar as, like you said, it is a 2D racer, and the drifting feels like, you know, like you fight it a little bit more, mm-hmm. less like it, you know, it flows better with the course, and more like,
yeah,
you have to direct it to flow with the course.
I mean, to me, it reminds me of Sonic Riders.
Also fair.
In Sonic Riders, it's more like drifting is like a pause button where you re-aim and then you launch yourself like a cannon.
Yeah.
And so taking turns early, like in Mario Kart, where you go wide and then drift early and then, like, take a sharp turn inward, that's just, like, not a thing you can do in Sonic Riders. And I think that's part of where the Riders DNA comes in with SRB2 Kart and then Ring Racers, along with the whole resource management system.
Yeah.
I love Sonic Riders. It's hard to get people to play it with me sometimes. and we don't have a huge scene of players here for, like, tournaments. But I love that game, and I love the competitive aspects of it. And it really feels like Ring Racers is aiming for that same crowd. And again, I fall squarely there, but I can recognize not many other people do. And, like, if it's hard to get Galen interested in it, or, like, to really enjoy playing it because it's difficult and, like, takes all these things and, like, works really different from other karting games, I can't imagine I'd get any of my other friends who I could play Mario Kart with to even try this.
Yeah. I love this game enough that I might continue to play it despite the fact that I don't like playing the game.
Yay.
But I do also, like I said, fundamentally, the criticism that I have is just that the skill floor is a little too high for, I think, a more casual crowd. And I don't know, like, I personally don't know how to change that.
Yeah.
If there's one thing I can think of, if there's, like, one, parentheses, one thing that I can say, and I know, like, again, I'm speaking into the aether here, I'm willing to bet that a dev would tell me this is a terrible idea, but there are many times where I don't have a mushroom, but I have, you know, like, I have a jackpot that I'm just sinking a whole bunch of coins into, and I'm going down, you know, down a slope. And it feels like I'm gaining enough speed that I should hit the point where I can just naturally go through a shortcut without a mushroom. And it never works. It never fucking works. And again, that is because of a very intentional design decision of, like, those are catch-up mechanics. Those are catch-up shortcuts primarily. But, like, it feels bad
when I'm
going over 200% speed and I still just eat shit.
Yeah, it's interesting because, like, they have this mechanic to where it's like, oh, if you're going fast enough, you can take these shortcuts without using an item. But it does feel like you never have enough speed to do that.
Yeah.
Maybe in Vicious you can, but certainly in lower, I say maybe because I haven't really gotten that opportunity yet. But in lower CCs, which is, you know, 3/4 of the game or something, 2/3 maybe, you really can't. And it's like, why'd you even bring it up then?
Yeah.
Like, it's cool and all, but you're not designing the courses around it. Yeah, it's really awkward in that regard. It's super tricky. I'm totally fine saying that this is a divisive game in terms of skill required. And, like, some of the design mechanics are very sink or swim. Yeah, I think, like, fan games have the privilege of being able to do that.
Yeah,
It's just like, this is a very big fan release, and I feel like when people see fan releases with a lot of people working on them, they expect it to be more widely marketable, even if that's not the case. See, like, the Strawberry Jam collab for Celeste is harder than Celeste, and I think, like, the first lobby is very approachable for people who've beaten the core, and maybe the second lobby, but, like, once you get past that, it's like, oh, you actually need to really learn shit for this.
Yeah.
Another good example is a lot of Mario World hacks that are, like, big collabs. They're funny, and they're interesting, but they still often require Kaizo mechanics or difficulty, and so you see them and you're like, oh, it's the funny hack where there's like the Turing Complete Mario level. It's like, oh, I'll try that. But then you realize that it's still a difficult hack. It's just that it has a higher production value.
Yeah.
I feel like it's the same for this, that it's like, oh, it's a big release. It's a huge fan game. There is articles on it all over the internet. It's still like a fan game for people who are really into competitive kart racers.
Yeah, it is still a niche-ish product, but mm-hmm. it's a niche product that has so much polish that it could probably break out of that niche a bit, and I hope it does.
Oh, and we are running a bit late, so we need to end it here. So thank you for listening. You can follow us on any podcasting platform you like. Let us know how we're doing. Let us know what you want us to cover, or just things we might be interested in. We're also now on YouTube Music, so if you're on YouTube, you can find us on YouTube at Netsurfer Pro Pod, or just Netsurfer Pro. You can also find us on Twitter and Blisky at Netsurfer Pro or netsurferpro.bsky.social. You can also follow me on those websites at Twackaroo on Twitter or twack.bsky.social. You can also follow my stream at twitch.tv/twack, where I stream a lot of video games, including even some ring racers, believe it or not.
As for myself, you can find me on Twitter and on TikTok at Galen Wilson. That's at GALENWILS0N. I post my hot takes and videos. I've been trying to do more political videos and stuff. You can also find me on YouTube at The Only Galen on YouTube and twitch.tv/machinegunvampire.
I'm a computer. The G.I. Joe PSA fan dubs are coming back.
Good. They're literally some of the earliest bits of, like, internet fucking humor.
I know a guy who knows the guys that made that.
Nice.
I'm 2 degrees away from the people that made the G.I. Joe PSAs.
And thus, 3 degrees away from Kevin Bacon. Fun fact.
Wait, really?
Yep.
Holy shit, my Bacon number is... Actually, I think mine was already at 3.
You know a guy who knows a guy who knows Kevin Bacon?
I think so.
Nice.
I have an actual Bacon number.
That's really funny.
Put it on the wiki. I don't know which wiki.
Kevin Bacon, if you want to come on here and talk about the one airplane movie that George Clooney filmed in St. Louis.
Oh, Up in the Air?
Yeah, Up in
Hell
the
yeah.
Air.
Then we can talk about the downfall of the Lambert International Airport. This is going in the episode. All this preamble is actually post-amble.
Excellent. Hi, my name's Post-Amble.
I love your music.